Let us move on then to item six, which is our review of total portfolio performance for the period ending June 30th, 2021. We have Mr. Price and Mr. Whalen, I see, on the left side of my gallery. Tim, are you going to kick this off, or is Mr. Whalen going to kick this off?
This is going to go to Mr. Whalen first.
All right. Scott, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I, as per usual, will be spending a little bit of time on the market environment and then jumping right into performance. In thinking about the market environment, there's really a couple of things, in my view, that's driving market activity these days. And it is all about COVID and COVID infection rates and the chances of that slowing down the economy. And inflation, on a related note, inflationary pressures that may or may not cause monetary policy to shift from being highly accommodative, easy for me to say, to being less so. And we should be learning more about that as Fed Chairman Powell is expected to make some comments on that at the retreat in Idaho going on currently. So with that, I'll turn your attention to first share my screen. Can I get the host to enable screen sharing? Thank you very much. So sharing my screen, I'll take you to slide 7. And talk a little bit about the economic environment in the U.S. So growth has come back pretty handily, and you would expect that given the low base that the pandemic caused. So we've bounced back to pre-pandemic levels, and GDP currently is above where it stood before the pandemic. So we've experienced pretty much a full recovery with growth continuing to expand. Inflationary pressures have come along with that growth, largely because we had a lot of stimulus, both monetary and fiscal, the fiscal stimulus putting money in people's pockets and enabling them to go out and spend. The problem was, of course, that those people that were spending weren't working and creating the goods and services that they were buying. So that demand supply imbalance has caused inflation, which is also off of a low base. And so there's that base effect there. And the real question that I'll talk about momentarily is whether or not that inflation is going to be transitory, which is the key word that everybody's been using lately. So inflation higher, and then rates have stayed low. You can see where they were in the beginning of the second half of last year. They came down significantly as we went through the beginning stages of the pandemic, and they've crept back up. And right now they're hovering at about 1.35, the 10-year treasury. Unemployment that shot up, as you would expect, at the beginning of the pandemic has also come down. It hasn't come down to pre-pandemic levels, and there's a participation rate issue that I'll touch on briefly as well. So talking about those two points that I wanted to cover, the first being the pandemic and its impact on markets. So really interestingly, we've seen with the Delta variant, we've seen infection rates start to creep up. We've seen breakthrough infections start to creep up. And in fact, sorry to say, my wife actually got a breakthrough infection and had to quarantine and stay home for a couple of weeks. Her symptoms were mild, and relatively speaking, she had a case of a bad flu case, and she felt pretty bad for 3 to 5 days or so, but it didn't lead to any real serious effects that caused hospitalization. So from that perspective, she was very representative of the breakthrough cases that seemed to be keeping people from going to the hospital and real serious consequences of the disease. You can see from this chart that those infection rates.
Was she vaccinated?
She was, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You can see from this chart that infection rates have begun to increase again, as I'm sure you're all aware. I have some other statistics that I think might be interesting and relative to forecasting what may happen to the economy and to markets. So if you go back to the worst days of the biggest wave when the infection rates were the highest, you were seeing a 7-day moving average in the US of daily new infections of about 254,000. That was back in mid-January. And then you saw them go all the way down in June to about 11,000, right? Moving daily average. So significant decrease. And then we've seen them spike again on August 20th to 144,000. So quite an increase from the low point, not to the high point before, but worrisome nonetheless, right? So as you're seeing these new infection rates, people are concerned that we may have additional shutdowns and really slowing economic activity. The good news is that the death rate has not increased nearly as much as the infection rate. So those same statistics back at the height, in January, you had about 3,500 deaths per day on a 7-day moving average. In early July, those dropped down to 237 deaths. And as we're seeing the infection rate spike, the death rate has only increased to 813 per day. So not to make light of 813 deaths per day, but significantly below that 3,500 peak, and on a relative basis, significantly below what's happening with the infection rate. So from that, I gather that we won't see the same response in terms of shutting down economic activity, and we'll likely, and markets are seeing that as well, and you haven't seen big sell-offs. Although when you see cases rise and bad news coming out on the pandemic, the market responds, but it's not a dramatic response. So the next point is on inflation. And of course, inflation is related, as we're seeing the stimulus drive demand and the slow opening of the economy drive supply. And so you can see here on slide 13, what's happened to CPI. So top line inflation, you can see sort of the spike there. And then you can see the components of CPI really being driven largely by energy. The increase is driven largely by energy. As you know, you probably see it every time you fill up your car. Gas prices in the US are approaching $5 a gallon and significantly higher than what they were a year ago. So the real question becomes, is this transitory or not? The Fed, and in fact, our research folks at Verus, believe that it is transitory, although it's, we get indications that on both sides that, you know, maybe it's going to be sticking around for longer. And when those indications come out, the market responds. The concern is that the Fed may need to raise rates and to curtail inflation. And of course, that would be detrimental to growth aspects of the economy. So those two things really seem to be driving the market today. Notwithstanding good news on those two fronts, the market seems to have lots of room to grow, or the economy seems to have lots of room to grow, and market valuations in that circumstance may be perfectly reasonable. The next point I want to make is on the labor market. And as you look at slide 15 here, slide 14, I went too far. If you look at slide 14 here, you can see how unemployment spiked and then dropped dramatically, right? This was really a very short-lived economic downturn, primarily because of the huge fiscal stimulus that the federal government put in place very quickly And then the interesting, so it's not all the way back to where it was, but where it was at historically low levels. The interesting thing here is the labor participation rate. So you see how, so the labor participation rate is folks that are working or looking for work, people that are out there in the labor force. And you can see how the labor participation rate dropped significantly as the pandemic took hold. And then it's rebounded, but it hasn't come back to pre-pandemic levels. So there's a couple of percentage points, 1 to 2 percentage points of folks out there that exited the labor force during the pandemic that have not come back. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation as to why it's, you know, maybe folks have decided to retire. Maybe folks have are not coming back and looking for work because of the, you know, there's a big debate about the ongoing support that's being provided. Interestingly, the unemployment rate has dropped notably in have ended the unemployment benefits. But the question is that labor participation rate going to come back? Are those folks going to come back to the workforce, or have they permanently left the workforce, leaving the workforce smaller, putting pressure on wages, and then again, potentially having the knock-on effect of leading to higher inflation? So all big questions that have yet to be answered, but things that that our capital markets research folks are paying close attention to. And then a couple more points on the economic environment before I'll turn to performance. And I just want to take you all the way to the back of this deck. Bear with me. Slide. With you. So on slide 43, this is not a slide I typically cover, but it shows private equity versus public market equity. And I'm bringing this up based on a couple of comments that I'll make as we get to the investment performance. And the it's interesting to note that private equity here has outperformed public equity. And I'm looking at this spread between total direct private equity investment and the Russell 3000 as its public market equivalent, pretty handily over time. Now that has dropped over time, but you can see that private equity, direct private equity is expected to earn a premium and has done so over time relative to public markets. So the point there is that you guys have a private markets program, you're continuing to build it out. And as you build it out, you would expect to realize this premium over time. And with that, I will pause and see if there are any questions before moving to performance.
David. Scott, private equity versus market, is that private equity net of fees?
Yes.
Okay, and is there a comparison to the S&P 500? Because that has outperformed the overall market, right?
So we could do a similar comparison to the S&P 500. I don't have that data, but you're right. In the last cycle that we've seen, the S&P 500 large cap stocks have actually outperformed the broader market. You wouldn't actually expect to see that over time, as you should get an additional risk premium associated with smaller cap stocks. But you're absolutely right. In the most recent cycle, and I don't know how long it is, but maybe over the last 3 years, the S&P would have outperformed the Russell 3000.
Any other questions for Scott? No, carry on.
Okay. So moving to performance. I'll take you to slide two, the second section of the deck. And here you can see you've really had a very strong year in the last 3 months. And so here we're looking at the last 3 months. You started with a little over 10 billion, net cash flow of negative 33 million, investment, net investment change of 600 million, taking you to almost 11 billion at the end of the quarter. And then on a calendar year to date basis, similarly strong performance, not quite as strong in the first quarter as the second, but started with, again, just over 10 billion, 134 million in negative net cash flow. Investment performance approaching $1 billion and getting you to that same nearly 11 billion at the end of the day. Moving to the next slide, just to show your asset allocation and how that has changed over time, really since the onset of the functionally focused portfolio. You can see here as you went really from, you know, mostly equity to the equity or mostly growth to the growth, liquidity, and diversifying. And then you can see just as, you know, the approach that you all take in terms of managing your liquid assets and paying benefits. So you get an injection into the plan, and then you slowly pay that down over time as the liquidity pool and cash pays out those benefits and expenses. And then you can see that over time, you stayed very close to your interim targets that are set each year through board resolution and right on top of those targets now. And then moving to the next slide, slide four, you can see your allocation relative to those targets across your different pools. So your long-term target, you're approaching your long-term targets that were laid out as part of the program initiation of growth at 76%, liquidity at 17%, which has come down, and diversifying as at 17%. So approaching those long-term targets as the program continues to ramp up. And then here, relative to your current targets, you can see above your current targets. Now, keep in mind, these have recently been adjusted through board resolution, and I'll give you those numbers now. The current target for growth is 75%. So you're right on top of that. The current target for liquidity is 18%, and for diversifying is 7%. So very close to your target allocation, and you've approached that target allocation, as I mentioned on the previous slide, as your liquidity pool has been drawn down to pay those benefits, and also as your growth pool has increased with market activity. And speaking of market activity, you can see that you've had just a tremendously strong year. The 1 year number for the total fund, 22.3%, good quarter to date as well. And calendar year to date, so 5.8 relative to the policy index of 4.9 for the year, 8.8 relative to the policy index of 8.2. Over the longer term, just strong absolute performance. And that 1 year number has now impacted the long-term numbers. So it seems like the experience from the pandemic, you know, that big drawdown and quick snapback, it doesn't even show up in these numbers. It was so short lived. And then for the longer term numbers, those 10-year numbers, the global financial crisis, of course, occurring in 2008 and the recovery beginning in 2009 is no longer in these 10-year numbers. So this is the first time that I've seen 10-year numbers where the return exceeds the actuarial assumed rate of return for all my clients. You know, I'm just very happy to be able to report that state of things. And then looking at the longer term, so as I pointed out, the total fund in the near term relative to the policy, ahead of policy. Looking at the longer term, you can see below the policy index, and largely due to the growth bucket there, as we've talked about in the past, and we'll talk a little bit more as we get into additional detail in a moment. If you look at the quarter to date, you can see that all pools are outperforming their benchmark pretty handily. And then on a year-to-date basis, you've got the growth bucket performing well, and as well as the diversifying and liquidity buckets. So in the nearer term, you're firing on all cylinders. Over the longer term, the growth bucket has been a little bit of a drag on the portfolio. One point I want to make here that I like to make every time, and I think you all are keenly aware, but it's worth pointing out, is that your all's risk that you're taking in the portfolio is less, and I can even say significantly less than your peer group on average. So of the 78 portfolios that report to the service that we use, the 78 public portfolios, public fund portfolios greater than $1 billion. You can see all the little blue dots there. If risk or volatility is measured across the x-axis, you can see where you sit, you and your policy sit relative to the median, which is this vertical line here, and then relative to all the dots. So interestingly, you are significantly less, taking significantly less risk with only a slight degradation to return. So your Sharpe ratio, that is your portfolio efficiency or return over risk, is very high at 1.07 and higher than most of your peers. You rank very high from an efficiency perspective. And so you can see that that is the case over both a 3-year and a 5-year period. Now, interestingly, I would expect to see, as time goes on, I would expect to see both the total fund performance and the policy index moving a little bit further to the right as you guys have recently reevaluated your risk tolerance and taken down the liquidity pool as a percentage of your total assets. And so your risk should shift to the right a little bit as that gets built out. And then we go to detailed performance on slide 8. And so here we're looking at gross of fees to be able to compare across universes, across other market participants. And so you can see here the very similar numbers, 5.9, 9.0, 22.6, taking you back to 8.9 on a 10-year basis gross of fees. Your 10-year number relative to your benchmark and peers is sort of you're very close to your policy benchmark, right in the middle of your peer group. And then you've got this risk reduction that I talked about, that in a rising market, you are showing ranking low relative to peers. You know, I take great comfort from the fact that in down markets, which we haven't seen a ton of, but we have seen some big drawdowns. So you may recall in the first and second quarters of last year, your rankings just shot up to the very top of the charts. So in volatile markets and during drawdowns, you get to enjoy the experience where your peer rankings go right to the top. Some points on performance underlying the different buckets. So you've got your growth bucket, and in your growth bucket, you see you've got domestic equity, you've got, you've also got, I'll show in a moment, international equity, global equity, and then some private market exposure. You can see in your domestic equity, so looking at the quarter, you've got good growth performance. Your domestic equity underperformed slightly in the quarter relative to the benchmark, and that was driven largely by a few managers. Notably, you've got Jackson Square, and Ceradex that have underperformed. And that underperformance for those two managers actually, sensitive mouse pad here, actually bleeds across to the since inception numbers, where they've underperformed since inception, both Jackson Square there and Ceradex. You know, staff has gone through and re-underwritten the managers in your global portfolio and your international portfolio, and are currently in the process of beginning to re-underwrite the total domestic equity portfolio. And we'll assist as called upon there, but as you wait and see to what happens with the managers in your domestic equity performance. Some of them have been showing disappointing performance. And then moving to international, so you can see your international numbers relative to its benchmarks and its rankings are very strong across time periods. Different reasons across different time periods. Most recently has been the performance of your emerging market equity sleeve within the international equity composite. And you can see there the performance and the rankings driven by both of your managers in the space, your value manager, which is a quant strategy, and which actually has struggled until the turnaround, the rotation into value recently, and they've outperformed strongly since then. And then TT Emerging Markets, also good, strong performance on the growth side. Global equity, you can see Artisan and First Eagle, you know, no real concerns here. You can see good, strong outperformance since inception. Strategies that fit in the overall portfolio and have contributed to performance there as well. And then moving into your private markets and as well as high yield. So you can see private credit has contributed to overall performance, as well as private equity. Although in this case, your private equity measured on a time-weighted rate of return basis, as we show for performance here, has not kept up with that Russell 3000. But the point here is that you are a couple of years into restructuring your private equity with StepStone, and the hope and certainly the intention is that you will be getting that premium over public markets over time. And with that, I will pause, see if there are any questions.
What do you think a reasonable period of time is on that latter reference you just made? If you can go back a screen or two, Scott.
To the private equity?
Yes.
Right here. So it is a long tail implementation process, right? You can't just snap your fingers and move and adjust your private markets program overnight. Right. As you know, I'm sure, Scott, it takes, you know, you've got to find the funds. The funds then capital is called over a 3-year investment period. You typically will wait another 5 years as those investments mature and play out and you get distributions from them. And then you also want to ensure vintage year diversification, right? You just don't want to commit all your capital to a single year and suffer the potential consequences of a big market drawdown in that year. So it takes time. Specifically to answer your question, a reasonable time period, you know, I think you're talking 5 to 8 years for a reasonable time period to evaluate the success of the program.
Okay. No, that's fair. And I appreciate the answer. I mean, I just wanted to get a sense of, you know, how far along that J curve you have to be.
Yeah.
It sounds like 5 to 8, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's So with that, if there are no more questions, I will unshare my screen and turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Jay Kwan has a question for you, Scott.
Jay.
Yeah. Hi, Scott. Just a quickie here. You noted a couple times that we shrank the size of the liquidity allocation, and you would expect over time to see the kind of risk profile of the plan creep to the right. Can you comment on that relative to, say, you know, the past year of Banner returns, really, for our plan as well as most other public plans, you know, numbers in the 20s, even 30% almost, to the extent that, you know, thing, kind of valuations across all asset classes are getting kind of expensive. It just happens to coincide with our plan taking a little bit more risk. And so if, you know, wanted to get your thoughts on what happens, the combination of those things, if that should prompt us to reconsider or, you know, adjust some tactical type exposures, or, you know, do we just stay the course and ride it out in the long term?
Yeah. Well, Jay, that is a really tough question, right? Because, of course, you're asking, what does the future hold? And are the valuations that we're seeing today stretched, or are they reasonable? And can we expect a drawdown? And Jay, I hate to tell you this, I do not know the answer to that. What I do know is that if the economy continues, then the valuations continues to grow, then the valuations are reasonable. If the economy turns and rates rise while the economy slows, we're all in a heap of trouble, and more risk will not be helpful. I just don't know which one of those scenarios is going to play out. Another thing that I will tell you is, even with your increased risk tolerance that you're legging into, right? Even with your increased risk tolerance, you will still protect on the downside relative to peers. You will start moving to the right on that chart, but you will still be to the left of the lion's share of your peers.
So no predictions then.
It's a great question though, Jay. It's,
I was really hoping for the crystal ball, the consultant crystal ball, to kind of put out some numbers here, but I just want to kind of lay the groundwork for the expectation amongst the trustees, I guess, in just knowing that, you know, as Scott noted, we're in this process of re-risking or upping the risk level of the plan. And that coincides with the market environment that, as you noted, potentially could get a little more volatile. So the interplay of those two things means it's not quite as it's not possibly not just calm waters ahead, right?
I 100% agree with everything you just said.
Excellent point. Any other thoughts or comments for Scott Whalen? It appears not. So thank you, Scott.
Certainly my pleasure. I will stick around, but turn off my my video and my volume. Thanks very much.
Very sorry, by the way, to hear about your wife. It sounds like she's on the mend and doing better, but that certainly it brings it home literally when you know you find out you know someone or someone close to you. So I appreciate your sharing that.
No, well, I certainly appreciate the concern and the consideration. I will tell you, to your point, man, it brings it home in a huge way, right? Like before, COVID was just something that was happening, and I saw the statistics and, of course, shared concern and sympathy, but you just get, it becomes everything, right? And it was quite a strange experience, but to the point, she is completely 100% better. And interestingly, nobody else in the house caught it. So it was a very happy ending from that perspective. Thanks very much.
Well, we're all delighted to hear it. Okay. Thanks for sharing, Scott. Telling. Mr. Price.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen and take you through the CIO report here. Bear with me one moment. Everyone see that okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Just as a reminder for new trustee on the line here, this is the supplemental report that we present every time we do a quarterly review. So Verus is responsible for being that outside voice, outside advisor to the trustees on how everything is doing big picture wise. This is a supplemental report that says, you know, within the functionally focused portfolio construct, there are different measures of success and different timeframes that we take a look at there. So this is just meant to round out the picture a little bit, and I'll take you through the report here. Let me start on page 3. And this is our report card to the trustees on how things are working within each one of the sub portfolios, what we're keeping an eye on, and whether it's meeting expectations or whether we have some work to do there. And you'll see that most items are meeting expectations, but there's a few things below expectations, and we'll discuss those as I move through the report here. Let's start with liquidity. Scott had mentioned the implementation of the new asset allocation. The board adopted new asset allocation targets in April, and we've been moving through the implementation. That really kind of wrapped up in late July, early August. So we're just on the backside of the implementation of the new asset allocation targets here. But within each one of those portfolios, liquidity continues to perform as expected. This is meant to be high quality, low risk. It is sized in terms of number of months of benefit payments and reserve. So you see the quality at AA-, well with line with meeting expectations, the duration at 1.8 years, definitely on the shorter end of the curve there. And you see, as of June 30th, at least, we had gotten down to 37 months of benefit payments in reserve. And you'll recall that, you know, the board made the choice to move from 4 years of benefit payments to 3 years of benefit payments in reserve. And we're simply letting the portfolio run down to that. So as of July, we were at the 36 month mark. Within the growth portfolio, and Scott had highlighted some challenges there, we take a look at, absolute returns, benchmark relative returns, and efficiency. So we would say, if we take a look at this and say, is it generating, strong returns for us on an absolute basis? Yes. Trailing five-year number of 12.1% net of fees. Here we measure just relative to a global public fund benchmark, global public equity benchmark, the ACWI benchmark. So US, Europe, Asia, both developed and emerging markets. And there we see a bit of a deficit, the 2.6%. And I think the areas that we look to as being a little bit as driving some of that is both the underperformance of private markets to date relative to the public markets, as well as the domestic equity portfolio. Now, one of those has been addressed. We've made the decisions over the past 3 to 5 years to migrate to a direct implementation model within private equity, to really start to carve out some of those fees and have a more customized program. And, I do think that we're starting to see the very beginnings of that bearing fruit, but we have quite a ways to go before that really gets baked into the overall results there. In the domestic equity review, I think that we're in the midst of a project right now that basically says, let's go through kind of line item by line item, what's working for Sisera, what needs to be addressed. And, I would expect there to be some conversations coming out of that with the trustees over the next quarter or so. But on an efficiency basis, we do continue to exceed that global public equity benchmark on a Sharpe ratio basis. So Sisera's got a Sharpe ratio of 1 over the past 5 years, and the MSCI ACWI at 0.8. So we're continuing to be more efficient in our implementation there. And then on risk diversifying, this has been an area that we've struggled in a bit over the years and has gone through restructuring over the past year here. This is meant to be an offset to the growth portfolio. It's meant to be there as a hedge against an equity market downturn, but still get paid along the way and be able to redeploy. So that correlation did creep up to 0.8. We would like that to be, you know, 0.5 or below. We have made some adjustments both late last year and more recently to reduce the exposure of a manager who was kind of driving some of that. And the positive real returns, you know, that stayed fairly flat. We have seen outperformance, you know, in the second quarter here, but it's going to take a while for that to get baked into those five-year numbers. It is, the portfolio does remain highly liquid. We can sell out of the entire thing within 90 days and, you know, less than that in reality. So we just take a step back and say, you know, are each one of those programs kind of meeting expectations? Yes, liquidity is working as expected. Growth is largely working as expected. Risk diversifying, we've made the adjustments we think are necessary. It's going to take some time to bear fruit there. So let me move to, before I address each one of the programs individually, let me just pause and see if there's any questions from the trustees.
Any questions for Tim? I'm not seeing any on my side view here, Tim. So
fair enough. So let's briefly go through kind of the manager line items here. So within the liquidity sub-portfolio on page 4 of the report, not a whole lot to report here. This is short duration fixed income. Everybody is, you know, kind of meeting expectations there. I will note that we see those portfolio average yields continuing to decline. And just to wrap this back to Trustee Kwan's comment in terms of valuations, you know, the fixed income market is trading at very low yields right now. That's a measure of how expensive it is. And that is a concern as well. So while we do recognize that the extended valuations in the public equity market are, you know, kind of driving the conversations, we're seeing very low yields in the public fixed income market as well, which contributes to those lower one-year total returns there. But relative to what's available in that segment of the market, we're comfortable with this manager lineup. Page 5, this just talks about organizational stability of the growth sub-portfolios managers. And you see most everything is in the green. We did highlight the reduction in strategy assets at Jackson Square last quarter. They were a sub-advisor to a Vanguard mutual fund. Vanguard took that money back. That's what's driving that one-year product asset reduction there. Adelante, nothing particular to report. AQR, you know, that firm-wide asset growth. Last year was a very difficult year for quantitatively oriented managers. That's come back in 2021, and they're having some strong results, but AQR had some pretty well-publicized client redemptions last year. If we go to performance, I do want to spend a moment on this slide here. So Trustee McDonald offered some good feedback last quarter about, you know, the readability of this page. And so we've tried to restructure it here a bit to include more pertinent information. So you see, we've included the global benchmark at the top. So you've always got that reference point there. Historically speaking, we'd focused on the 1 year and 5 year number, the 5 year being the main focus, the 1 year giving us some information about where the 5 year might be heading. And we took a look at this and said, you know, it's really 5 to 10. And so let's provide a little bit more context there. So we've extended that out a bit. And, you know, then we can take a look at, we added in the composites for domestic equity, international equity, and global equity, where we had the information to, again, provide a little bit more context here. So the story in the short term has really been the, and if we go all the way down to the bottom, if you look at private equity, private credit, and real estate, you know, those numbers relative to that global benchmark has been a challenge. Now, I will say, you know, a couple of things to note within private equity. We are migrating to the direct model. The other thing that does influence those private equity numbers is we folded all of our legacy infrastructure and real asset mandates into this, and they just have a much lower return profile in general. So this is metals and mining and power lines and that sort of thing. And typically we're looking at, you know, high single digit expectations of returns within that segment. We used to have a real asset mandate. When we didn't, we folded those private pieces into the private equity. So When we do the deep dive private equity review later this year, we'll try to pull those apart and give you a little bit more clarity around what's driving those numbers, and you know, both by vintage year and by segment of private equity. And we'll have a hopefully a more fulsome discussion there than, you know, when it's all put together here. Obviously, those are the results, but we want to understand some of the drivers in a bit more detail. The other things to comment on this slide would be, you know, that value rotation that has really come back. So if we take a look at, you know, within the domestic equity program, Boston Partners had been lagging, you know, the broad market and the growth peers by quite a bit. They've snapped back with a 50% return in the past year, which has brought up those longer term numbers. Ceradex has snapped back, although not in keeping, did not keep up with their benchmark as much, but against kind of a broader global benchmark, performing fairly well there. The only other thing I wanted, Scott had already mentioned the emerging market snapback. And the only other thing I wanted to mention on here is just on Allianz, which is a high yield manager. You know, that trailing 10-year number of 5% is below what we would expect there. We've reduced this portfolio. It's basically a holding place for assets intended for private credit at this point. So that one is in drawdown mode there. And let me move to slide 9. This is the risk diversifying sub-portfolio. So within this space, the parametric strategy, which was, you know, intended to be kind of a return generator and risk neutral, showed a higher correlation than we had expected in the drawdown last March and April. So we reduced its exposure in 2020, and we reduced its exposure again in 2021. Now, it has behaved better more recently, but we did see that in an emergency. We saw that spike up there. Acadian was funded just about a year ago, so we don't have quite 1 year of experience here. The numbers you see are their composite numbers, so we can look back a little bit further. And then SIT was funded in April, or I believe earlier this year. So, you know, we'll start to see those numbers come in, but they did have a good second quarter. They returned 3.8%, I believe, in the second quarter. So, you know, one quarter does not make a track record necessarily, but we did see a good start out of the gate for them. And we did increase their allocation as well. So that's the sub portfolios. Let's wrap it all up to the total. Go to slide 11 here. In the quarter, let's start with the top, the total fund quarterly attribution. Each one of the sub portfolios outperformed kind of that simple target index performance number there. So we saw outperformance across the board. Allocation differences were kind of washed out there. And so, you know, about a 50 basis point excess return versus the simplest possible implementation of the simple target index. And then if we take a look at the efficiency basis on that next table there, we see, you know, we do note underperformance relative to the simple target index really for the past 1 to 5 years, but with a much lower return or risk profile. And so we have higher Sharpe ratios across the board there, going back over all trailing time periods. So this is something we'll be taking a look at as we move forward. Obviously, the relative increase in exposure to the growth portfolio and the reduction of liquidity portfolio will start to bleed into some of these total fund figures. But we do take a look at each one of the programs individually as well. So the only other thing I would mention is that risk posture really was implemented after this time period, and we'll touch base on that in the next agenda item on the rebalancing. But let me stop there and address any trustee questions.
I'm looking for questions. I don't see any right now, but I do have a comment. Jay kind of got into my head with that comment on the policy change from 4 years to 3 years, and I was sitting listening to you go through the remainder of the numbers. I was remembering that I actually thought the case was made that you could go to 2 years based on known and studied duration of downturns. right? So even even if you looked at winter, as we might describe it or see it, even the global financial crisis, what was it, 6 to 8 quarters, somewhere in there, right? About 2 years or less of a pretty crazy time, and probably was actually less than eight full quarters. So, I mean, it's an interesting point. You're in a time of rising valuations and in a very heated market. We're kind of leaning in by going to a 3 year versus 4 year. But you know, the old saw is you can never time the market. But it is an interesting cautionary and something for us to think about. It's sort of ultimately there may be consequences. Who knows? But we're built to weather that, right? So. At least that's my sense.
We are. And I think when we studied this at the outset of the asset allocation in 2015, we said, you know, basically, let's look back over the past 30 or 40 years. I don't recall exactly what the time frame was, but multiple decades. You know, what's the longest downturn and how long did it take to recover? And I believe the number we came up with 21 months. So 21 months was the longest we'd experienced, you know, in medium-term history here. I do think one of the things to keep in mind is the behavior of the Federal Reserve in response to equity market downturns and, you know, shocks to the system is materially different than it was in the 50s, 60s, 70s. You know, we've seen them become increasingly activist and not tolerating downturns. And so, you know, the negative of that is you could say that the equity markets are a bit dependent or a bit, you know, they've locked up the Federal Reserve's actions there, but it does have the consequence of shorter and shorter equity market drawdown periods and extended valuations. So it is a little bit of uncharted waters. We don't know what the future is going to hold, but we do take, you know, a long-term view. So Verus came in and gave you 10-year forecast return assumptions. And we, you know, the board collectively made that decision to reduce the liquidity portfolio. I will say that, you know, while we have concerns over increasing volatility in the equity markets, I also have concerns about, you know, holding assets with a zero or negative real expected rate of return, which is, you know, what we were, you know, dangerously close to seeing within some of the short duration fixed income there. So, you know, risk is embedded across the portfolio, but I think, you know, the board made a wise and, you know, well-informed decision to adjust the asset allocation, which has now been implemented. But yeah, Mr. Chair, there are potential consequences as there are with any investment program.
Yep. Is what it is. Any other thoughts or comments, questions for Tim?
Yes, I have a question about slide 6, Tim, just for my own education, I guess. Why is Jackson Square marked as not in line? Because I'm looking, the year one is definitely lower, but if you look at 5 and 10, it's actually better than everybody else. So even...
It is. So the performance in line with expectations, you know, we have... individual expectations set for every one of the investment managers. And some managers were expecting to be lower risk and downside protectors. Some managers were expecting to really outperform in a strong growth market. Jackson Square is a large cap biased US manager. That space has really driven the market over this past decade. And you know, they've been on the lower end of participation in that. So if you take a look at slide, if we get over to slide 7, we have a manager thesis for every one of the investment managers. So when we're taking a look at relative to expectations, it's both relative to that global benchmark and relative to the more qualitative set of expectations we have for each one of the managers there. So that, you know, we would highlight Jackson Square and Ceredex as, you know, while the absolute returns have been solid, our expectations were that they were going to be a little bit more outsized in this particular market environment.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Tim, on the same page, it used to be in past experience, there was the dreaded watch list. and that seems to have kind of lost a little bit of its emphasis. But to what extent is Ceradex aware that we're watching them and we're not happy with what's been going on for some time?
We've been in conversation with them fairly extensively, and continue to be in conversation with them. I mean, the entire domestic equity structure is up for review, and that's not to say we're going to make wholesale changes. But it is when we go through an asset allocation, it's a good time to say, you know, we're moving the relative weights of these managers around. And if they're increasing, we want to make sure that, you know, they're representative of the space that we expect them to inhabit as part of the asset allocation, and, you know, and they're, you know, fulfilling the roles we have there. So, all four of the active managers, we have been in conversation with and continue to be in conversation with. The study is ongoing. I would expect there to be some results from that study in the next quarter or so. So I don't think anybody is unaware of the fact that Cicera has a new asset allocation, that Cicera is reviewing you know, their role in that, and will make changes as necessary.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Tim? It looks like not. So thank you, Tim, on that report.
Absolutely.